Watchers in the fourth dimension.
Too late for all the meddling fools. All the blows to be sucked.
Never trust a man as well as that.
Hello and welcome back to Watchers in the Fourth Dimension. I'm Anthony.
I'm Julie.
And I'm Riley, and Trogs always work harder after a good sacrifice.
This episode, we'll be heading into a story where the Argonautica meets a CSO nightmare in Underworld. But before we get into that, Julie's going to take a quick look at the mail. Over to you, Julie.
We have one quick one for the Underwater Menace. So from Arl Grey, who's Robert Lloyd? Some random nerd?
I'd know, but he sounds very fishy to me.
Oh boy.
That was a fun one. On to the invisible enemy. Our friend Mark Dunkston says, this was obviously a ripoff costing a few pounds. Yeah. A shoddy production. No, you're right. Yes. A shoddy production, but enjoyable in Spain. Those massive prawns are called gambas? Gambas?
Gambas.
Please help me out here. Gambas? Without the trolley assistance, as we're getting weird here, Leela still the best, even though she was meant to be Raquel Welch.
Okay.
Oh, okay. All right.
And if the doctor got injected in his bum, this would have been a six-parter.
Thank God they went straight in through, I don't know, was it the ear or the neck, but much closer to the brain.
Oh, boy.
And contact has been made.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Starting strong. All right. David Gorton says, part one is sound, but does lose its way a bit once they get to the foundation. Frederick Jaeger is fun as Marius, but the rest of the staff there seem very two-dimensional. They weren't given anything to do, so yes, I agree. To be honest, it's one of those which works better in audio when you don't have the giant prawn.
Yeah, I could see that. I guess, yeah.
6 pre-cut scenery bits out of 10. Now, our friend Nick Rutherford says, I had a feeling Riley would enjoy this slightly more than Julian Anthony, as he did champion the Sensorites and the Web Planet, and I agree with him.
I draw the line at shellfish.
This is a mixture of stunning and shit. I tried to say it with a straight face and I just couldn't, everyone. Everyone's imagination just far exceeds the budget. You can't hate them for that. In the days when repeats were rare, it was shown again this following summer, so must have been pretty popular at the time. That is true. P.S. And don't forget, this isn't even the worst one of the season.
Hey, Julie, before we go on to the next one, Riley, I do just want to remind you that while you did not rate this one as highly as the Sensorites or the Web Planet, you did rate it higher than either Julie or myself.
Yes.
So Julie gave it a 2.5. I gave it a 3. You gave it a 5.
I know who I am. I'm true to myself. What can I say?
Our good dear friend, Alan Seiler. Well, this went about as well as I expected. After 4 really great Leela stories, the bottom falls out beneath their plates of meat. Thank you, Alan. The production simply demanded too much from the meager budget, but that can be forgiven, and has been many times on Doctor Who, if the story being told is good. And as the Watchers rightly point out, this script has a lot of problems, particularly its attitude toward Leela. Yes.
Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I can overlook a lot, but the fetishistic prawn, the facial makeup on the possessed people, and the extensive shoddy CSO make it really difficult. On the bright side, we have a lovely friendship between Leela and K-9 blooming. And in fact, if it weren't for the introduction of K-9, no one would remember this story. So a very mixed bag. I'll give you 4 all-you-can-eat shrimp buffets out of 10.
Nice.
Thank you, Alan. All right, friend JM Casey says, listening to the behind-the-scenes and summaries of the Bristol Boys script on Watchers in the Fourth Dimension is somehow really exciting. I'm glad it is.
Well, we got another one today.
Yep.
Then I remember how their concepts always seem to flout the budget of Doctor Who, something they were surely aware of, but they just went ahead with this crazy stuff anyway and had to have most of it rewritten. Granted, that rewriting apparently didn't happen here. And there are other problems with this besides the basic script concept, and they make stories like this, and maybe their next entry too, seem worse than they otherwise would be. Oh boy.
Wow.
Tony Monticello says, I don't disagree with the criticisms The Invisible Enemy earns, but I do enjoy it considerably more than most. Thing is, in 1977, I was part of Doctor Who's target audience. Elements that older viewers naturally find ridiculous were very effective to 8-year-old me. And nostalgia is one hell of a drug, especially when we're discussing the stories that formed and informed my love for Doctor Who. I think we all get it. Usually Anthony is that person.
Yes. Yes, I am.
We're still in impossible to be objective territory and will be for a few more stories. Even while admitting, yeah, this story is pretty crap, the worst I can give it is 7 TARDIS trainers out of 10. If nothing else, it's good campy fun. Contact has been made. Now, Kieran James Evans. Maybe it's VHS nostalgia, but I don't mind this one. Okay, another one of these. Yes, there's crap in it, but there's also some good stuff, and I appreciate that more. But yes, the script is very mean towards Leela and changes its mind on why she can't be infected. The first 3 parts says it's because of her primitiveness, but then part 4 has her having the antibodies in her bloodstream because she is from the future. Okay. So her being back in time compared to her home means she's given the people in the past the cure. Therefore, it's a bootstrap paradox.
How did we miss that?
Yeah, good point.
I don't know how we missed that.
That's a good observation, Karen.
Yeah, I think it's because you were distracted by the sexy shrimp. That's why.
Horny prawn.
And yes, Michael Sheard has his 4th appearance. The Ark, Mind of Evil, and Pyramids of Mars. Just 2 more to go. A more generous 5.5 out of 10, contact has been made.
I'm seeing a theme here.
There is a theme here. Is everyone brainwashed? Thank you, everyone. Now on to our friend, Beardo Beatnik.
Beardo.
Yes. I had a long diatribe prepared. Then I listened to the podcast, and now I think Anthony summed up the whole thing at the top of the hour with his remark, it's an absolute shit show. Thanks, Anthony. 4 out of 10, contact has been made.
Oh, there it is again.
All right, dear listener, as we are doing Underworld this episode, I'm going to challenge all of you to find a better metric for your scores than whatever out of 10 the quest is the quest.
The challenge has been laid out.
I look forward to reading the mail or hearing the mail next time. Austin D. Patterson says, the last time I watched this, I remember thinking that the best effect in this story was the lightning storm in space. But in rewatching it to catch up with you guys, I don't know why I thought that. At a time when Star Wars had that opening shot that literally had people ducking in the theater, it's unfortunate that Doctor Who had effects that even had the actors laughing. People often say the worst thing Doctor Who can be is boring, but to me, the worst thing Doctor Who can be is not beautiful. Invisible Enemy disappointed me in this regard, and there are other season 15 stories coming up that do the same. Oh boy.
And just for context, Austin, I believe, is a model. And so it makes sense that the beautiful person gets disappointed when Doctor Who is not beautiful. I kind of like that.
All right, guys, I promise we're almost done. Our friend Paul Arthur, Doctor Who's 60s, 70s, and 80s. Another great episode. Although it seems I definitely enjoy the story more than you guys. That also seems to be a very common thread.
Yeah.
Just to follow up on the Star Wars connection. Yes, it's true that Star Wars didn't arrive in the UK until the very end of 77, but I always get the impression that the hype was already crossing the pond earlier in the year. I definitely think visual effects designer Ian Skoons packing this one full of model shots is a response to A New Hope. They may be a bit inconsistent and they are never going to match Star Wars, but I love the ambition shown. It's a shame the Randy Prawn is disappointing.
Hey, what's this A New Hope thing? I don't think I've heard of that. Is that the same thing as Star Wars? Sorry, I'm trolling.
I'm like, I'm not even going to respond to that, Anthony.
I can't believe that after seeing Star Wars, if that's the theory that we're going with, that he decided to try to match the model work with a Doctor Who budget. I don't think that's New Hope. I think that's No Hope. And thank you. Good night.
All right, let's get through the mail, guys. Our friend David Patty says, Just listened to the Invisible Enemy podcast. Enjoyed it a lot more than I enjoy the story. Biggest laugh was Anthony saying, and it's a prawn. Wonderful. Yes, thank you. I think this one got it from all sides. Transitions between script editors, new producer, pressure to tone down the scares, and no budget at all. Partly overspend on previous serials, partly general inflation. Got to say, though, I think this is the worst script, but it ain't the cheapest looking one of the season.
This is such a threat that I keep hearing throughout this mail segment.
This is probably my favorite of the metrics. 3, is that shrimp getting bigger or is it just pleased to see me's?
Oh, God.
Out of 10.
And Riley, just so you know the gravity of the threat, I think we're about to discuss the true cheapest one of the season.
Okay.
Please continue, Julie.
And last but not least is Jamie Revel. I remember really liking this one as a kid when it first came out. I guess I appreciated the weirdness in throwing so many ideas into that. It seemed cool to me at the time. Plus K-9, of course. But unlike some others, it's hard to look at now as an adult and recapture any of that. Yes, there's a certain nostalgia, but the flaws are just too evident. Ambitious, certainly, but that's as much as one can say in its favor. So, and I pick this metric purely because it isn't easy to say. Great, thanks. 4 out of 10.
Do you want me to try, Julie?
Yes, please.
4 out of 10 uncarcinized malacostracans with anaeramus periapods from me. I think that's it.
Wow.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And Anthony, it's now back to you.
Thank you, Julie. And as a reminder to our listeners, as you know, we really do love getting your feedback, thoughts, comments, and questions, and we do try to read out as many as possible on the show. So please do get in touch. As always, you can contact us through Facebook, Instagram, and the platform formerly known as Twitter, @Watches4D, or you can email us at watches4d@gmail.com. And also, we would absolutely love it if you subscribe to the podcast and dropped us a review or rating on your podcasting platform of choice. And looking behind the scenes on Underworld, our story here starts with script editor Robert Holmes leaving the show halfway through season 15, and it was agreed that his successor, Anthony Reed, would have full control over the season's final two serials. Reed was soon finding himself discussing ideas for the season finale with newcomer David Weir, but Reed realized that Weir's scripts would need a lot of attention. As a result, Reed wanted to put the season's penultimate story in experienced hands so that he could focus on the finale. Holmes recommended Bob Baker and Dave Martin, the Bristol boys themselves, for this role, who, of course, had already contributed The Invisible Enemy to the season. More horny prawns. More horny prawns. Holmes had shamelessly ripped off classic literature to inspire ideas for Doctor Who during his own time on the show. Seeing the benefits of this approach, Reed was thinking along similar lines and suggested that the Bristol boys look to Greek mythology, and the three of them started focusing on the legend of the Argo. The resulting scripts entitled Underworld were commissioned on June 23rd, 1977. In their scripts, Baker and Martin barely tried to hide their influences, with various names very clearly paying homage to their classical counterparts. They also took a few things from other inspirations. The race banks came from an article in Scientific American about genetics. The character of Ankh was named for an Egyptian symbol for life, while Luck came from an Indian word for 100,000, referring to the time span of the Minions' quest. They also gave the guards names from modern times. Rask was named for Danish philologist Rasmus Rask, Tarn for French poet Pauline Tarn, and Klimt for Austrian painter Gustav Klimt. They also drew upon some of their own work, giving the Minions a motto, "The quest is the quest," which drew upon "Eldrad must live from the hand of fear, and contact has been made from the invisible enemy." And as they had created K-9, Reed also asked them to provide a strong role for everyone's favourite metal pooch. To direct Underworld, producer Graham Williams requested the services of director Norman Stewart. Stewart was usually a production assistant, but also occasionally worked as a director. Joining Stewart's core behind-the-scenes team were Dudley Simpson, returning to provide music for the 49th time, Dick Coles as designer, and this was his first credited contribution to the show, although he had previously been an uncredited design assistant on Season 7's The Ambassadors of Death. And this team is rounded out by costume designer Rupert Jarvis, also making the first of his four contributions to the show. With the core team established, Williams was concerned that the broadcast of Underworld would coincide with the UK release of Star Wars, and he knew that the show's usual production standards would not compare well against the new box office smash hit. To enhance the serial's visual appeal, Williams and Stewart decided to invest the majority of the budget into two impressive sets, the R1C, which could also then be redressed as the P7E, as well as the Caverns. Feeling confident about the show, in late summer 1977, Williams went on holiday for 2 weeks. This was a mistake.
Oh boy.
On his return, the end of season 15 was pretty much in freefall. Not only had Weir badly misjudged what was possible on a Doctor Who budget, rendering the season finale Killers of the Dark totally unusable, more on that next time, but runaway inflation in the UK meant that the estimates for the Underworld sets came in at three times the anticipated budget. This was on the background of Williams' one major directive on taking the role as producer being to cut down on spending. I mean, and also to reduce the violence, but let's not let that get in the way of a good story. With that, he was left with two options: either truncate the season so that it ended with Underworld, or find a way to make it work. He decided to find a way to make it work. To cut costs on Underworld, Williams abandoned the proposed cavern sets and instead represented the subterranean environment with model work, onto which the cast would be superimposed via CSO. Despite the fact that such extensive CSO work had never been attempted before in a BBC production, Stewart believed that it was feasible. The cast and crew found the recording method for this to be extremely frustrating and nerve-wracking, with Tom Baker unsurprisingly becoming rather bad-tempered. His ongoing displeasure with the character of Leela was particularly obvious in his bad temper, and this further strained his already tense relationship with Louise Jameson, which is really sad because that had been improving the last few stories. Anyway, as a result of this, during recording, Jameson reconfirmed to Williams that she had no intention of returning to the show for season 16. Williams started considering the character of the next companion, and we'll come back to that next season, but sensing an opportunity, the agent of Imogen Bickford-Smith, the actress who played Tala, started publicly touting Tala as Leela's replacement in a bid to get the actress more exposure, even though the production team never actually considered this as a possibility. And I also think Imogen Bickford-Smith has about 17 credits on IMDb, so it clearly didn't do that much good. Anyway, Underworld was originally intended to be broadcast starting on December 24th, 1977, but it was decided that the show would take a two-week break during the holidays, and part one of Underworld instead premiered on January the 7th, 1978, and would continue for 4 weeks on Saturdays. So that takes us into this episode's short summary, which is in the hands of Riley this time. Over to you, my friend.
The Doctor, Leela, and K-9 find themselves on a ship crewed by an alien race called the Minions that discovered many years ago that the Time Lords are dicks. So they kick the Time Lords out, only to later destroy their own planet. So with the aid of a machine that removes badly applied old age makeup, they are desperately trying to find the other Minion ship that contains their, quote, race banks, so that they can start again on a new planet. We later find out that these race banks are the size of two Red Bulls. Now, why these cylinders need to be put on a different ship is something you shouldn't worry about. Anyway, what stands between the Minions and their race banks are nebulas, beings slowly turned into a chocolate malt ball, skyfalls, authorities wearing the newest in S&M fashions, and a computer who likes executions that are planned by Wile E. Coyote. In the end, the Minions get their race banks, the Doctor gets to make comparisons to Greek mythology to Leela, and K-9 gets to tell him that he is incorrect. The end.
Oh boy.
All right, guys, let's talk about it. Part one.
Yeah, that flight deck, the money, yeah, I think it looks good. Other than the bargain sofas, I think that was probably the last thing they bought. But the sofas include carbomagnetic seat locks, so that's a nice bonus feature when you go and buy that from like a furniture store.
Before we get onto that, we're straight into the TARDIS. I mean, the last two stories, it's been like 6 minutes and four minutes before we see the Doctor and Leela. We see them pretty much straight away, and Leela's back in her Coachella outfit.
Yeah, I still don't like that outfit. I do like the Doctor in his painting outfit, though.
Yeah, that's rather fun. My initial impression of this story, part one, the FX are good. The model work looks good. We start off with a pretty cool crisis. We're on the edge of the cosmos, which may or not be the same place as in Planet of Evil. But the setup here is pretty solid. And then we cut to that spacecraft bridge set, which is also really good. You can see where the money went.
Yeah.
Yes, I am really happy with a lot of the things, again, especially in this part one. As you mentioned, model work is actually very good for Doctor Who in this season.
Yeah, that wouldn't actually look out of place on, dare I say, Star Wars.
No, it really wouldn't. And the set design was good. The fact that they were able to kind of utilize it in more than one place is great. I didn't even really notice that all that much. They didn't make it as obvious as they could have. Or maybe I'm just not observant. I don't know. I had some questions about the outfits, but the costuming is a little bit iffy.
Yeah, I mean, it was the costume designer's first time on Doctor Who. Let's give him some grace.
Yeah, we also know what they did in their spare time.
Oh, boy. Let's talk about the Time Lords here.
Okay.
Because we talk about how they're dicks, and we get a little bit of an insight into the Time Lords before their current time period. I've always wondered if this is a deliberate attempt to almost reconcile the godlike Time Lords we saw at the end of the Troughton era and through most of the Pertwee era with the rather boring and decaying Time Lords we saw in The Deadly Assassin. They used to be all-powerful gods, and then these guys came along and they realized the errors of their ways and so became reclusive. I don't know if that was a deliberate decision, but I like that idea. I would like to think that was their thinking. I don't know, though.
I love the backstory. I think there's a lot of parts of this story are helped greatly by having a backstory that is that interesting, and I really enjoyed that part of it. Particularly the fact that we then are led in to believe that the character of Herrick is going to be our classic Who anger issues character. And we're like, oh, great. So he hates Time Lords. Guess he's going to stroll upon the bridge, da-da-da-da-da. But it resolves itself. And actually, Herrick has some depth. He isn't that same character over and over again. And I greatly appreciated that because I felt like we're going to go down that route again. So that was positive. And by having that background still there, and then the history going forward, it's interesting. I like it. It just adds a flair to it.
And you know what? I think Alan Lake, who plays Herrick, is great.
Yes.
Yes.
I think he is probably the strongest one. Very sad story about him. He is, as far as I know, one of the only actors to have appeared in Doctor who died by suicide.
Oh my God.
So 1984, so 6 years after this. But he had a part in Blake 7. He was great in that. He was in all sorts of the usual BBC type things, Zed Cars and Dixon of Doc Green and what have you. But yeah, he was awesome in this.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
So we have a couple things happen. We have the Doctor telling Leela it was okay to carry the weapon around.
I love how she immediately knows how to work it as well.
I think she's learned a few things in the many places that she's been, that she's learning different weapons.
But these shield guns are like the weirdest thing she's seen. She even makes a comment about it straight after shooting it. I know, I get it, but it's a little inconsistent, even within the script for this story.
It's still better than her getting hit with a pacifier ray gun.
Right. It seemed a bit confusing. For Herrick, it pacified him. For Leela, it kind of made her flirty with everybody. It's not the same thing.
It's because they don't know how to write for women.
Ah.
But at least they have women in this story, Julie.
It's true, but I'm glad it didn't last very long.
Mm.
I greatly enjoyed her being really pissed off when she shrugged it off. That was very
super
fun and
angry,
enjoyable.
Leela.
Yeah, I like that.
Super angry.
But yes, when it was mentioned that it could take hours to wear off, I was like, oh no, don't have this last that long. And I'm so glad that they had the Doctor pull her out of it. That was great. And they all could have learned a few things, though, when K-9 is trying to tell them things, but they never listen to K-9 because obviously he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Poor K-9. When they hook K-9 up to the ship.
With the office clips.
The binder clips and two telephone cords that they haven't even bothered to spray paint. Like, at least spray paint them gold or something. Jesus fucking Christ.
They just went down the hall to the office just real quick, grab a couple supplies, come back, let's go.
Hey, Graham, have you got anything you don't need here? We're going to use it in the show.
It was also like they were going to hook him up to a car battery.
Yeah.
Is that the negative side? This is the positive side?
Just zero effort to disguise those supplies. Amazing. All right. These guys have regeneration to an extent.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up because That leads me into my comment about Dudders for this cereal. This is the first time in a while where I really happened to take notice, for better and for worse, the music. And the region had a really interesting little bit of music playing with a very heavy on the piano. And I don't know, it was fine. It was nice. It struck me. I wasn't just watching the old removal of old age makeup one screen capture at a time. It was nice.
And look, it's another pretty blonde.
I mean, let's be honest. Men like pretty blondes.
No comment.
Uh-huh.
Just one note on the music. We'll come back to it. But there is one thing in this story, music-wise, that I found particularly awful. And we'll get to that later.
Oh, yeah. There's good and bad.
I think you mean awfully good, Anthony. If I know what you're talking about, if I have a guess, it's awfully good.
Don't make me fire you, Riley.
As we're getting into the nebula and we're seeing all this happen, at this point, the CSO seems better than normal.
Oh, on the view screen?
Yes.
That's fine there, yeah.
Yeah. I do want to talk about this, because they go into the nebula, stuff starts sticking to the ship hull, and it's very quickly being turned into a planet. If the science were actually accurate, this could have filled the show's original educational remit. But guys, this isn't how physics work.
Yeah, I'm not a physicist, as you all may know, but I thought that was a wonderfully weird, wild plot device, and I really, really liked it. I know it's the basis for everything, because it sets up to the audience what they're about to do by crashing through another planetary body to get to the underworld. But it may not be accurate, but I thought it was a lot of fun.
It was fun, definitely.
That's where I'm at. I have a tendency, when things are sci-fi, I feel like real science doesn't matter. And I kind of let a lot of it go to the wayside. I know that's not the original intent of this Doctor Who thing, but you know what? Let's just see how this rolls. And I really enjoyed it.
I find that as a pH test in regards to how a story is going, that something can be so clearly incorrect, but you're still in it. You're able to pave that over. And we already mentioned that the first episode is good. It sets up a good premise. Everything looks good. And I think as we're getting covered in, we'll say, Cocoa Puffs, we move on to part two.
I do want to kind of talk about the ending to part one a little. So more and more stuff is sticking to them. They are trying to blast their way out, and it isn't working. The cannon's disintegrating, and that's our cliffhanger. But we don't really see a lot of that. It's a lot of word peril more than anything else.
Fair enough.
They do a pretty good job of ramping up the tension. You can see Herrick freaking out about it. And I think that it would have been really hard to do, especially on the limited budget that they were on. So I get why they went with a lot of words, but I didn't feel like it took away that much.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, that moves us on to part two, and we have a long recap.
Yes.
Yes, we do.
Only for that plan to then work and they just accelerate out.
Well, it had to happen at the right moment.
Yes.
And it happened when penetration happened.
Yay. Happy fun time.
It's fine. Things happened.
All right, so we very quickly come across this planet that P7E is in the middle of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a soft planet? Is that even a thing? I don't know.
Right, that's the beauty of this, is that it's wild, it's weird, it probably is completely, as you said previously, factually, scientifically wrong, but damn, it's a lot of fun to watch their ship crash through, or I guess get dunked into a pond of some sort, and then all of a sudden you see CSO Wonderland, and then there's people that look like cavemen running around, and I'm saying, what the fuck is going on?
But guys, do you not see that they were just foreshadowing the next Star Wars movie because they just landed on Dagobah?
Oh, boom. Yeah, there it is. Who's stealing from who now? Okay.
Yeah, Lucas is definitely ripping off Doctor Who. All right, let's address the elephant in the room, the CSO caves.
Oh, God.
The thing is, I don't hate them as much as I've hated other things. Let's talk about the tank.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like they're not remotely convincing that it's anything other than CSO, but we've seen worse CSO previously. I get what they were trying to do. They couldn't afford the real sets, right? So they're like, okay, we're just going to make it work. And I can forgive it.
I'm going to have to show off my ignorance here. Why couldn't they just shoot in a cave off of a quarry or something? Was that just too expensive? I guess the lighting would have been too much.
Yeah, you have to pay for everyone to get there. You then have to pay for the setup. You have to hire generators.
Right.
The cost of doing that was prohibitive. Location filming's expensive, so they were really trying to do what they could on like $2 and a ball of string.
Well, it gave such a strange effect, particularly when our Trog of note, whose name eludes me right now, as he's running away, it's like you're watching someone not really run. They're just kind of like floating. It looks like some sort of bad DVD slash video game from like the late 80s, early 90s of how he would like run around. It definitely brought me back. To go to your point, yeah, we've seen worse. And yes, this is bad. But once again, I'm enjoying the story so far. It's not bothering me. I'm willing to let it go.
That's kind of where I was. I was like, yeah, I can forgive this.
Well, the story is actually well-rounded. And I can tell there's been, I wouldn't say some edits, but there's been some thought put behind this. And honestly, even if all things said and done, their script didn't seem to have any crazy prawns or anything of that nature. So they actually stuck pretty close to something that could actually be shot.
Yeah, I'm wondering if maybe they were sat down and being like, all right, guys, Bob Holmes has left. We're going to need you to actually act like mature adult script writers because no one's going to pick up the slack for you. So please do something decent.
What I find interesting, we've got another situation where there's this group of people that have been stuck in this planet for so long that they now don't remember where they come from. They don't remember that it was a ship. You've got one section of people that are leading the others through fear and superstition.
Mm-hmm.
It's well done. It is a really great setup. And I love when they do this because it gives it more depth in history.
And I actually want to talk about the costumes, the guards and the seers, until the seers take off their hoods. Those costumes look really cool. They look like medieval executioners.
They do. It was very interesting. And I'm glad to see that in the future, the fashion has switched from big shoulder pads to oversized helmets. What I'm referring to is that when our crew goes into the planet for the first time, their spacesuit helmets were gigantic. But yes, yeah. Anthony, they did look like medieval executioners, and I really did like that look.
In this episode, fundamentally, we have a lot of wandering and running around in CSO caves. That's the majority of this. There are some cool touches. The R1C crew put down markers, which is very evocative of Theseus in the labyrinth. One thing I do love here is Herrick.
Yes.
Starts having the best time when he takes on Klimt.
Oh.
And he's arrogant enough to radio the guards back and then gets trapped and fumigated.
So good.
He's amazing.
Well, Herrick also has that wonderful line, "Don't trog me."
Yeah. He might be my favorite character in this. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Everyone gets trapped by this fumigation. Leela's pissed and she looks so hot when she's pissed. And we end the episode with the doctor trying to reverse the fumigation and says, whatever blows can be sucked. Okay, doctor, And then he passes out and that's the cliffhanger and we're into part three.
At this point, I say to myself, as long as this doesn't jump the shark, this might be my favorite episode of the season or story of the season.
Before we move on, once again, Dudders, the fumigation sucking scene theme, quite interesting. He's turned off the piano and now gone back to his old favorite synth. But there'll be more to come from Dudders later on.
Yeah.
And now we are into part three.
With another super long recap. Again, money was short, so I guess they're trying to maximize what they can with these. I love how the doctor actually did reverse it. And it's awfully, awfully convenient that it reverses direct into the guards' control room.
But yes. I think one of my favorite things is the doctor actually asking, I wonder where that went.
Yeah. Who designed this? Were they idiots? Apparently. Idris becomes cool. And the doctor's like, yes, we're going to go save your dad from execution. And Leela is just fantastic. I love the line she says, do not worry, he has saved many fathers. And I can't quite explain why, But I thought that was really funny.
Yeah, that was a good line. I mean, I agree. And also, it's strange that now we've had two straight serials where an authoritative governing body, whatever you want to call it, is setting up for an execution.
Yeah.
And also, I love how, because of the last story, Leela is immediately saying, revolution.
The spirit of Vicky continues.
Yes.
And I believe it is in part three where Leela found a weapon and she was just seemed so happy to find it. And that's just so her. And I don't ever want her to leave.
She is the best in this. She becomes very maternal towards Idis, maybe because she sees a little bit of her own history in him and his people.
Yeah.
There's also the point where the doctor hands her the apple for her to throw and she just starts eating it.
Right, right.
That was really funny. There's humor in this, I swear.
There is.
Yes. I love so much of what's happening. First off, I do have questions, though. K-9 doing so well on the uneven cavern floor.
Yeah.
Great job, K-9. Don't know how you did that. And then we get some more fun electricity like we had in previous stories, but it's not so bad. Although I'm really curious of how Leela knows immediately where to shoot to disable the door.
Doesn't the doctor tell her?
Well, it's just like a saying of see where it originates from. And I'm like, how in the world do you see where it originates from?
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
No, please. But how about that zero gravity bit that was going on?
Oh my God.
So again, this is not how physics work. And also the music during that scene was special.
Wonderful.
And not in a good way.
It was especially wonderful is what he was trying to say.
You're fired.
But what I enjoyed about it, joking aside, it was incredibly silly sounding. It reminded me of, and this is quite a deep cut, it sounded like music from a Super Nintendo RPG from the 90s. It felt like that. It was almost like a precursor to it. It really shocked me, but it was the very silly Willy Wonka in the pop soda room kind of scene. And I just want to know how the actors were directed as they were standing still to act like they were falling through this.
And you could tell that Tom Baker did not care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Louise Jameson
absolutely
is
not
trying her best to do whatever she can. And she's wonderful.
And what's funny is that even though the music is not good and it looks really silly, it does provide us, which I think is one of the best. Well, actually, I don't know if we've had a smash cut like this before, but one of the funniest cuts in the entirety of this show so far is when we have our shot at the execution chamber where the Oracle is. And you see the sword, and the sword falls, and om, om, om. And then, transition, hard cut, Idis, and the sword falls. And as the silly music comes right back, and do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That, I stopped and had to rewind that a couple times. That was so funny.
I have a couple things about the ceremony. First off, it's a good thing people love ceremony, because if we didn't, then he'd already be dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love a good ritual, you know me.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Also, I love that they tell me exactly what's happening as it's going on. Lamp, burn, sword, fall. Great. Thank you. I need to be told every single little thing that's happening and what's going to happen because of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I love it so much.
Yes. And what exactly, when they go through the ritual, they say is the question of the sword. What is the question? Will it impale me when it falls on me? Is that the question?
Pretty much. And poor Idmon having to lie there with this sword dangling over his head.
Yeah.
I mean, I do love that when the Dr. Leela and Idis get there, it's Idis who pushes his dad out of the way. I mean, what a guy. But, oi, I mean, I guess the whole thing is just making someone's last 10 minutes as agonizingly tense as possible. It's a total dick thing to do.
Hey, that's how you get those trogs to work harder, I'm told.
Yeah.
I find it amazing that they didn't stretch it out. It was very fast. Okay, boom, come in here. 2 seconds later, push the guy out of the way. Seconds later, and then the crew comes in. And oh, that was really fun. Herrick was having the time of his life.
He just wanted to kill a lot of people, apparently. And he was having a blast.
He proper Leroy Jenkins'd it.
He did.
Absolute mad lad.
Yes.
He was loving every single second of that and was like, just let me go out in one final blaze of glory.
I legend. Love that.
And that's the funny thing is that after that shootout in the Oracle Room, and then they have their little escape, and then they're on that bridge, and then he has that moment of, oh, well, you guys go. It's all right. And he says, I waited a long time for this. To get shot to death on a bridge is what he waited a long time for, I guess.
Riley, it was to do something that wasn't the monotony of being brought back 100 times.
And have to chase down a ship. Yeah, okay, yes. Fair enough.
I have to say one thing, guys. When Herrick gets captured and he's getting tortured, finally got Rumble to be concerned again.
Hey.
Due to the electronic squealing that was happening when Herrick was being tortured.
That headset on Herrick... Those look like the same Bose headphones that Boss had put on Pertwee in The Green Death.
Oh, you're probably right.
All right, let's talk about the silliest thing in this episode, and that is what's under the Seer's hoods.
Oh, that's the silliest thing? I thought the low gravity...
Oh, no. I mean, we've evolved far beyond minions. They pull off their hoods to reveal what look like metal helmets, but are apparently what they now look like.
Yeah, I couldn't figure that one out either. Are they robots or are they people or they're people that turn into robots? I don't know.
When I look at the next episode and we hear more about the Oracle and the Oracle creating themselves, I then think that that's how the Seers got created. That would be my assumption just because they're made of metal. They seem more robotic and that they just say that because that's how the Oracle got them to think of their existence.
Okay, that works.
That's me headcanoning it. But I think that makes a lot more sense than the other thing.
Yeah, I would agree. That works a lot better.
Well, and I like that scene because, as we've already discussed, we all seem to be big fans of Herrick, and he's excellent in that. He's strong. He goes back and forth with them. And I couldn't help but think, as he was stating that we are minions, how would this serial have been if it was actually played by the DreamWorks minions instead of...
Yes, I even had that. I was like, they look really goofy. Their domed heads make me think of the minions.
There it is. Yeah. See, once again, the show is putting out those seeds to influence people later.
Can I just say, I love the minions completely unironically. I love those movies and those little idiots. They're amazing. Anyway... Mm.
Last thing about our reveal at the end of part three, it's just a small thing. I really do love the fact that the fashion of the, whatever you want to call them, the controllers.
The Seers.
Seers. Everyone wearing hoods is done purposefully so the ones that are robots can hide their otherness to everyone else. And yeah. I just thought that's a really nice touch. They all wear the same type of hoods, but... That's just for the Trogs to not realize, like, oh, shit, these people are actually robots.
Did we also notice that one of them was longer than the other?
Yes.
Okay.
So we end with this scene of the Doctor and Leela. I'm not quite sure what they thought they were doing in the mines, but almost ending up going into the Crusher.
Yeah, that was strange.
Just a bit.
Okay, Bob and Dave, I think that needed maybe another draft to figure out how that was properly working.
Who knows? Maybe they had it making sense, but the director didn't know quite how to do it on the budget.
I think I know what happened. So it was an older Trog was pushing the minecart that they were in. I think it was intentional for him to slip to cause the diversion, but his slip pushed the cart too hard and too fast, and that's why it almost pushed through them into the... That's what I think what happened.
Okay, that makes slightly more sense.
Mm-hmm.
In part four?
Mm-hmm.
Part four, and holy shit, another absurdly long recap.
Yes, well, again, budget.
Yeah.
Sometimes BritBox gives you the option to press skip.
Well, I was watching on DVD, so I didn't have that luxury, Riley.
I had a question or two. I thought the whole point was for them to sneak in. And
yes.
They did not sneak in. That was not sneaking in.
Because their plan went wrong. Really wrong.
That was like one of the worst parts of this whole story.
Yeah. Rescue, alarms blaring, et cetera. The cliffhanger and its resolution, in my opinion, were just not great.
But that's okay, because there's a lot of other good things to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm with you.
I love when Herrick comes... And he says, we can end this. And he says, the quest is over. He looks so, like, ridiculous because he looks so upbeat. but he's just been tortured. Oh man, I just this man, I feel for him so much.
Right. And we haven't touched on a crucial plot point, is that he's been given what he believes are the race banks.
Right. And of course, they are not.
Correct. And now that leads the Doctor into going into the Oracle's chamber. And I gotta say, I could listen to Tom Baker trash talk the Oracle for a good 5 minutes. Just their delivery and a self-aggrandizing artifact. Just amazing.
Yeah, he was great. I did think, you know, you've got this society that's regressed. You've got this megalomaniacal computer. It is looking a bit face of evil. I think they looked at Chris Boucher's paper on this one and kind of cribbed it a little bit.
But the whole society being run or secretly run by a supercomputer and the people are kind of at the whim of the computer, that is just a classic old trope in sci-fi. I feel like that was like every fourth or fifth episode of Star Trek, the original series.
It definitely was. I think there were three in particular that I thought of, which were For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, Return of the Archons, and The Cloud Minders.
Okay, I think the Apple had that as well, but it's been a while.
But you're right, it's a definite trope.
And you know, there's nothing wrong with that if it's executed well, because obviously if things aren't tropes unless they usually work, because no one would keep doing them. And I could listen to Tom Baker trash talk the Oracle for 5 minutes, and you're not going to get that without a supercomputer that has done bad things.
Real bad things.
I had a few questions that never got answered, and I'll forgive those things for not being answered, but the Oracle has these people doing a lot of the work, right? I have questions on how the rock is processed into food.
Don't think about it too hard.
That's the only question that I have that's probably going to haunt me, is that right there.
Yeah, don't think about it.
And I also have a question. So I know the Oracle's purpose was to protect the race banks. So I guess the conflict here is that the Oracle doesn't believe that the crew are the minions that are meant to deliver the race banks to Minyos 2?
I guess not.
Okay. Because couldn't the supercomputer scan them and see? But we also learned that the supercomputer, the Oracle, it takes a good long while to scan things, particularly when things are returned to it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think probably it's more just a case of no one else should be the guardian of these except me. I think it's at that point taking its mission so strictly. That's kind of how I contextualize that in my head. But yes, the amount of time it took to scan the returned fake cylinders was a little silly.
So the Doctor and Leela run away only to get trapped, even though they don't actually want them trapped. So I'm like, why did we just do that?
A little bit of tension.
Right. I feel like it is unnecessary because then the way it paints the crew after going through all this with them, it's just like, yeah, hell, leave them. How dare they? They're a second late. All right, just leave them here.
Get out of
here. Bye. What? I mean, damn, that's cold.
But I love how K-9 is like, nope, you're not going without them. What an absolute little legend.
Yeah, he's
and
a good
he
dog.
He rescued them. I love him. He is the best boy.
All right, I love K-9's sass.
Ugh.
Right, so the Doctor says, what kept you, K-9? And K-9 responds with, gratitude is unnecessary. Speed is vital. What a sassy little fucker. It's amazing.
Yeah.
The Doctor is like, well, we obviously have to save all these people. And Jackson goes on this like rant about how it's too much weight. And he's like, but this is your own people.
Bruh, they are your legacy.
And it's so interesting because I still don't think it really dawns on them.
It doesn't.
Guys, do you not get it? It's so obvious.
No, they don't get it.
You're right. There was no revelation scene for them. They just had one purpose. They had narrow focus just to get those cylinders, and that was it.
To be fair, they've been alive for 100,000 years.
And that's the only thing they've been focused on. So, you know, to hammer everything as a nail, right?
There was the potential for more to be explored here. There are a few kind of themes that were left hanging. Again, I think this probably could have done with maybe another draft or two, but honestly, I think it's a miracle this got made at all. with the budget restrictions. Let's talk about the ending, because the Doctor's plan all along, having brought the slaves on board, was knowing that they didn't have enough fuel to get them out and to ride the shockwave of the blast from him destroying the P7E, Oracle, and the planet. That's some really good thinking from the Doctor.
I mean, I'm assuming it's the Doctor, so he probably did the math in his head or something, but that seems like a hell of a gamble.
Well, I think it was two things. It's riding the shockwave, but it's also because he was blowing up the planet, the gravity would be gone. That was pulling them in.
Oh, that's also a good point.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Julie.
Some of the science works, but not all of it.
So on his way out, the Doctor calls Jax and Jason, just because if you didn't get it before, you get it now.
Right.
And once again, K-9's used for some closing humor, and that's the end of our story. Before we go ahead to rate it, there were zero instances of jelly babies. Zero, I'll explain later. What are we going to give this for camp count, guys? Is this worthy?
I don't have anything for camp.
No. I don't think for camp.
Herrick was a little campy.
Oh, no.
No.
Okay. All right.
For the Quarry query, you could have put a should have.
No, that doesn't count. Okay. No quarries in this. Just CSO. All right. Let's go ahead and rate this in that case. And I have the dubious pleasure of going first this time. And I'm going to start by letting you guys know this one historically has not done well in fan polls.
Yes.
And we have been throughout this season apparently going against fan opinion, and I am going to continue that trend. Does this look unconvincing? Yes. Was this put together on the budget of £2, a pack of gum, and a ball of string? Also, yes. Was this a lot of fun? Yes. And did it kind of fall apart at the end a little bit? Yeah, but I can forgive it. I enjoyed this a lot more than I was expecting to. This is another one where I don't have a huge amount of childhood nostalgia for. I think that's the case through the entire season. And yet, I was very surprised by how much I liked this one. It's fun. It's got a good story. The supporting cast are a lot of fun. The costumes are pretty bonkers, particularly those helmets. Have we heard the storyline before? Yes, but it's done competently. I think there was so much more that could have gone wrong on this one. I am really willing to forgive the production values, and so, just for the enjoyment factor alone, I think I have to give this one 7.5 fumigations out of 10. Julie, what have you got?
I don't know that I have much to disagree with you about. I rather enjoyed this one. I think that the sets that they did use were really good. I really liked the design. I think the CSO, while, yes, not the most convincing, was still better than things I've seen on Doctor Who before. The story is good. The casting is good. Herrick is wonderful. And it's very quick. There's not a lot of drag in this story. So I'm going to have to agree with Anthony. And I'm going to say 7.5 spank. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Ray spanks out of 10.
All right, Riley, bring it home.
Wow. When we started tonight, I honestly had no idea where everyone was going to go with this. I was a little nervous, but actually kind of looking forward to maybe having a disagreement, but there won't be. I really enjoyed this one. The Doctor and Leela both shine, as well as K-9. Our supporting characters are well done, and we've already mentioned Herrick, and I'll mention him again. He was amazing. He showed depth. He wasn't just the basic Classic Who hothead stock character. I believe that the parts of the serial that didn't rely on CSO were very well executed. It's a basic story of two sides fighting over a MacGuffin, but little detailed flares like the minions having regeneration and going on and on and on. Both ships being turned into planets, just a weird abstract kind of visual. It really adds a lot. It makes it much more interesting. I think those tidbits plus the execution and the pacing do a great job to distract from the CSO and the plot holes. So I'm going to give this 8.5 strange weapons you shouldn't play with out of 10.
Holy shit.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but I really, really like this one.
So that gives us a story average of 7.83, which makes it the highest rated of the season so far.
No shit.
I can't wait to read the Facebook and Instagram comments of everyone continuing to disagree with us, because that's apparently the theme of the season. But cool, I'm actually feeling pretty happy about this. that brings us to the end of the episode. We will be back next episode because we haven't had enough of the Time Lords being dicks. So we're going to Gallifrey and the invasion of time. Again, wanted to set expectations there. In the meantime, thank you everyone so very much for listening. And of course, have a good one. You have been listening to Watchers in the Fourth Dimension with Riley Schreck, Julie Filipek, and myself, Anthony Williams. This episode, $2 in a Ball of String, was recorded on Tuesday the 20th of February, 2024. If this is your first time listening into the show, all of our previous episodes are available wherever you like to get your podcasts. You can interact with us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Watchers4D, and you can also email us at watchers4d@gmail.com. If you're enjoying the show, please do subscribe and consider leaving us a review or rating on your favorite podcasting app. All of those things really do help the show. And always remember, sometimes we keep this end of the show piece serious. As we mentioned Alan Lake's sad passing, we wanted to let you know that if you're struggling and experiencing suicidal thoughts, there are options for help. In the USA, you can call the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. In the UK, you can call the Samaritans at 116 123. And in Australia, you can call Lifeline Australia at 13 11 14. For the remaining 7.5% of our listeners, there are resources available in your countries. Please do look it up on Google and take appropriate action in reaching out if you are struggling. Thank you.